ABC Listen.
Australia's always been the lucky country, sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, AI, it's exploding into our daily lives, isn't it? But could AI develop consciousness? One to rival our own. G'day, it's Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with an episode that will make you really think about the future of thinking. Yes, scientists are exploring all the ways that we might fuse machines and brains, artificial intelligence with human intelligence, fleshware and software, the biological and the digital. Could this unlock a whole new cognitive potential? Or threaten our own agency and what makes us distinctly human? Well, to consider the intriguing, perhaps unnerving possibilities of a near future that's coming at us very fast, let's meet Professor Paul Davies. He's a theoretical physicist at Arizona State University and best-selling author. Dr. Ines Hipolito is an assistant professor of philosophy of artificial intelligence at Macquarie University. Dr. Brett Kagan is the chief scientific officer at Cortical Labs. Now, that's a startup looking at integrating hardware, software, and synthetic biology to explore how to harness intelligence from neurons on a chip. And Dr. Sandra Peter, an associate professor at the University of Sydney Business School, is hosting this Sydney Opera House event.
Paul, I'll start with you on this one. Is it conscious? Will it be conscious? What do we know about consciousness?
There's something weird going on between my ears. Somehow the swirling electrical patterns are generating this amazing thing called consciousness. And we don't know how. We'd like to know how. Is it the stuff of which my brain is made? Is there some sort of ghostly, ethereal mind stuff sloshing around inside my head? Is there some quantum jiggery-pokery, perhaps, underpinning it all? The question that occurs to me, I think occurs to a lot of people, if it's electrical patterns, if it's something distinctive about the, and that's the convention about the electrical patterns in my head, what is so special about those patterns? There's a lot of electrical patterns swirling around in Sydney Opera House, and it isn't conscious, or at least if it is, it's not telling us. So what is the thing that is so distinctive about what's going on in brains? And I don't think we know. That's problem number one. Problem number two, let me demonstrate something truly, truly amazing to a physicist. I think I would like to raise my arm. Good heavens, it moved. Now, how did that happen? How did thoughts move matter? How does information in my head bring about a change of physical substance in the world? What is going on there? And now, I'm sure that Inish thinks I'm talking nonsense, and I probably am talking nonsense, but this is known as the mind-body problem. How do minds gain purchase over physical matter in the universe? And that ties in with a whole lot of other things that we may get into. Volition implies that there is, I have a sense of agency, I'm an agent, I have a sort of autonomy. I used to believe I had free will, but my wife tells me I don't as far as she's concerned.
And she is always right.
Exactly. She's out there somewhere. I would say most of my scientific colleagues and philosophy colleagues really think that free will is an illusion or a confusion or something of that sort. And yet it's such a powerful part of daily life. And it connects with all sorts of other things that may be of interest to our audience, like criminal responsibility and under what circumstances might we, if we're trying to define consciousness, we might want to consider someone with locked-in syndrome or brain death or abortion. You know, all of these areas are important to have an understanding of consciousness. And so your original question, I'm going to stop here. Your original question is AI conscious or becoming conscious? Are we approaching that? And I would simply say the type of systems that at the moment we call AI, definitely no. But, you know, could a clever scientist like Brett cook up something a bit different from that in the lab in the future, in a dish, in a vat, something of that sort? Is that going to be possible? Would that be conscious? And I would say yes. And so the answer to your question about what is consciousness is, I haven't a clue.
So if we're talking about consciousness, this wave of AI again got people thinking, oh, maybe there's something going on, because it does sound human, which makes us think that there's something else. But Inesh, maybe if I go to you, this seems to be a misconception that we always come back to. Why do these persist? When we had expert systems, people were like, oh my God, Eliza, the first chatbot, you know, it's conscious. Why do we keep having these misconceptions?
Yeah, that's very right. So for the longest time, ever since Aristotle, Descartes, we've made this analogy of the mind being a computer. It's known as the mind machines metaphor. And later on, it comes up more prominently with the Turing machines, right? And after that, what happens is that we start using or combining this shared toolkit between psychology and computer science and AI with the rise of AI interchangeably, right? So we start using this toolkit, and that seems to be useful at the time, but more recently at the light of philosophical discussions or empirical research, we realize that it may not be the case that that mind-machine metaphor is going to really lead us into understanding the idiosyncrasies of consciousness.
So if this can't get us there, no consciousness for now, machines are currently not like organisms, we seem to not be able to create this in silicon, what if we started completely differently and we started with some different trajectory? We know what trajectory silicon puts us on, but what if we tried an alternative to machine learning? And Brett, maybe a different way of doing AI.
You know, it's an interesting idea when you come down to the raw material that makes us us. And you know, I think when you think about what you really are, you think, I have a hand, but am I a hand? Not really. What most of us are is this little, you know, bit of floating matter that sits between our ears. It's our brain. That what drives us, what makes us us. And what we were interested in is, if when you look at, let's say, AI, as we say it now, what are they doing? They're creating something called an artificial neural network. And they're going to enormous lengths, using enormous power, enormous efforts, to try and recreate this thing that naturally occurs not just in all of us, but in flies, birds, bees, and cats. And so we sort of came up with the question, I said, well, why would we try to mimic what we could harness? And with synthetic biology, you can grow brain cells and you can interact with them using small electrical pulses. And we thought, what if we could just figure out the underlying dynamics, not at the neurotransmitter dopamine level that people love to talk about, but at the level of information and physics? Could we drive this system in a useful direction? And I think it reflects on some of the comments we've heard already on what leads to consciousness. And, you know, I guess I would push back and say, I think that consciousness very well may be substrate independent. In other words, it may arise not just in our brains, but that doesn't mean that it will arise in something like a large language model. And it comes down to the complexity. And we're yet to see any other structure. The only thing in the universe that may compare to the complexity of the human brain, really, is the universe itself, the cosmological galaxies at scale interacting at beyond our imagination.
So how are you going about trying to solve this problem? What have you built in the lab?
Well, we're not trying to create consciousness. And there are two approaches people go down. One is, I want to create a brain in a box because we have brains that are useful. And we're interested in this approach, especially because if we can do that, we can try and better figure out approaches for brain diseases, test better drugs. And there's huge problems in getting these out to markets at the moment. The other approach, though, is the engineering approach, where what we do is we create the specific problem-solving circuits we want and move forward that way. And consciousness for us is a question we look at from an ethical perspective, mainly with the view to minimize suffering. But what we're interested in is utility and intelligence. And to me, that's a far more exciting question.
So you're putting neurons together instead of silicon and trying to harness what neurons, the way neurons talk to each other.
Yeah, essentially. And what's nice, because at the end of the day, this systems that we create that we call synthetic biological intelligence interacts with silicon through electricity. And electricity, for anyone who's watched The Matrix, you'll remember, is this shared language between machine and the brain. And so it gives us these capabilities to play with them and to see where it could lead.
Can I come back to you, Paul? Consciousness, does it make a difference if we start where breath is starting, not silicon?
Right, I just see it as you've got the top-down approach. You can have some vast computer system and hope that might have some aspects of consciousness. Or you can take Brett's bottom-up approach. You realize that something rather special is going on in brains, and so you start with sort of small amounts of brain material and try to build up, and maybe these two things will meet in the middle. I'm really interested in whether there really is some sort of new physics going on in brains. Some of my colleagues think that there are some sort of quantum effects going on in the brain. I'm very skeptical of that, but I think we have to be open-minded. I just don't think we at this stage have very much idea about what it is that is creating this phenomenon.
One thing that occurs in the brain that is absent in, say, LLMs or ChatGPT is this huge multiplicative interaction effect across scales. So it's not just neurons in the brain. Neurons have their own computational processes that are called dendrites that engage in their own sort of processing, which then communicate to the neurons. And neurons communicate in networks, and the networks then can expand out and grow in size. And all of this, and I think this is one of the most fascinating things, differs depending on the time scale you look at it. And so this level of physical complexity, and we could go deep into the math, but let's not, it just does lead to things that are unique to this system that we call the brain. And quantum might very well be a part of it, or as you say, it might not be.
Rod, I want to touch a little bit on the fact that you talked a little bit about how we connect some of these systems to silicon and how we start to interface. And there's a number of ways in which recently we've started to interface between the brain and different systems, artificial intelligence, machine learning, even large language models. We might one day connect your systems, but we are already doing some of this with things like Neuralink. We're decoding words that patients say, we're giving them back the use of their arms or their legs. On the news was a patient with ALS who has lost their speech, connected through, it wasn't Neuralink, it was one of the BlackRock initiatives, and it has given him back voice using one of the a similar technology to what you've seen with My Deep Fake, but using his voice before he lost the use of it. And Inesh, I see you looking at me. There's a lot of uncertainty around this and a lot of cultural baggage that comes with any of these conversations of brain implants. How do we think about connecting biological systems and silicon?
Yes, so this is a crucial question that we have in the future, which, for starters, we may want to ask the question of whether cognition comes down to the brain and, you know, neural dynamics and those kinds of things, and whether we're going to find consciousness in those neural dynamics, right? It is, of course, quite the case that the brain is part of a biological system, and the biological system is situated in a very, very specific environment like ours. And then we come to be agents in the ways that we are. So I think that we need to, if we are to think about consciousness or mind and intentional behavior, then we need to have that kind of conversation. So it doesn't reduce to, you know, brains at work. It doesn't reduce to neural dynamics, even though this kind of research is incredibly useful and a breakthrough for many of the conditions that we may find. But if we are to talk about what is a mental life, what is an experiential life in the real world, then, well, the brain is part of the organism, and the organism is situated in a social, cultural environment. environment. And what it means is that we have intentionality to go on and about and explore the world, and the world, the ecological world, invites us for exploration, and we explore the world in ways that they are meaningful to us. So it's beyond the survival of our own self, but it's in ways that it is meaningful to us, given the social cultural space that we are at. So I think that that needs to be brought in if we are to talk about consciousness.
So I know what many people think when they start hearing things about brain implants and about, you know, neural tissue in a vat and so on. Is this something we should be afraid of? With the technology that we have now, we've heard about individuals getting back some of their limb function or being able to control things on a computer screen or even have a voice through a computer. Could we be controlling people? Are we controlling brains? Is this something that we should be afraid of?
To me?
Why not, Brad?
I don't think fear is a place that any of us should be moving with these advancements. There's enormous hope, and to sacrifice the hope of leading the world to a better pathway because of the fear of risks in of itself, I think would be a grave mistake. We take great care, and in fact, our first works were ethical works on how this technology could be built before we even published on the technology itself. And so we work very closely to make sure that it's built, established, and used in a responsible and ethical way. And as people, we are capable of doing that. We're also, as we've seen, unfortunately, capable of having things co-opted and corrupted. And so it comes down to...
We're great at that, too.
We're great at having things co-opted and corrupted, unfortunately. But the flip side can occur as well. And it comes down to not just people like us sitting on stage, but it comes down to everybody here to say, don't let fear drive you with the possibilities of what the future might bring, but instead consider them critically and figure out where can good arise and support that and think, where do we need to consider more? And I think that's an important thing that everyone can take part of. It's not just restricted to a few people.
We've got these baby steps now where you can wear a helmet and it'll read your brainwaves and translate that in the future into thoughts. And so people can peer into your mind and you can enlarge your mind, your mental space, by coupling it to some broader computer system. And the technology for doing that, it exists, that technology of detecting what's going on inside your head. Does that raise ethical concerns?
It does. It does indeed. Because it's part of what Brett is working on, which is this kind of like known as neuroenhancement, when we replace parts of the brain with this artificial intelligence, so to speak, kind of like driven systems. And the major moral question about that is about accountability, because it may be the case, so this is the debate, it may be the case that we are not going to be aware of our actions, and then it's going to be the case that we are going to be morally accountable for our actions, given that some parts of our brain have been replaced and the AI is the one that is doing the interpretation of what shall be done. So that's the moral question that comes up with that.
Brad, can I bring you in here? Because you read some of these electrical impulses in the work that you do. How far are we from these scenarios, and what are we actually able to do at this point in the lab? How afraid should we be of this?
Okay, so there's two angles. One, you said, how afraid should we be of AI? I think we should be afraid of AI, but not for the reasons Paul brought up. I think we should be afraid of AI because currently the amount of power being consumed, the amount of water being consumed, the amount of money, frankly, being directed to a few very powerful individuals in this world, further widening the income gaps that we have and the wealth gaps that we have, are terrifying. These are systems now where there's discussions of legislation to limit how many of these systems can exist and how many of these data centers can exist in any one state, lest it crash the power grid. Meanwhile, we're tackling global warming. And are we going to let a few people do this so we can generate eight-legged versions of cats? I think we should be worried about that. In terms of how far are we from being able to read and upload minds, I think there's two things. One is, technically, we're very far from this. Where we're interacting with them at this point is, you know, as I said, at the level of information, particularly information entropy is one of the things we focus on, trying to minimize the difference between predictions of these simple systems and the virtual reality or embodied world we put them in. And so what I think is also interesting to question, though, is we're not helpless observers in this case. We can choose where we want to direct the science. And so one beautiful thing that I think could arise out of this work, where we try to investigate at the core level what makes us us, what makes us intelligent, what makes anything intelligent, for that matter, is it's natural. And the natural world is a beautiful thing. And sometimes the instinctive reaction is to go, yuck. But when you stop that and you think and you go, consider what could be done for this. Let's say we discover a group of cells in the dish can experience anything at all. That doesn't just reflect on what it means for us. It reflects with how we treat every living thing in nature and perhaps a level of respect in how we should be interacting with it. So I think it could lead to a beautiful world if we can just start to understand.
But just to reflect for the audience, when Brett says things like it consumes more power, or, you know, it takes a lot of energy to do these things, just to give you that magnitude for DeepMind to train one of these models, the ones, for instance, that fold proteins and so on, it's about 25,000 GPUs daisy chained together. That is about 4 soccer fields of GPUs that run together to train one model. Costs about $1.3, $1.5 billion to train it once. So the energy consumption is indeed huge for companies like Microsoft and Google. The energy consumption last year has gone up by 50%. So it could stall momentum when we think about energy transition, when we think about sustainability and all those.
Can I just chip in with a question then for Brett? Because, of course, it's well known that the human brain operates with an energy budget of just a light bulb, in fact, even a dim light bulb.
Less, yeah.
And so, you know, what sort of thermodynamic magic is going on up here that you can get away with such a limited amount? It's playing the margins of the second law of thermodynamics. So you do mini brains in dishes. Any clues as to how they can be so economical on the energy budget?
It comes down to to say parallel processing is underselling it. When you look at the dynamic actions that are going on and how these things influence each other. But essentially, that's what it comes down to. It's got the fact that you have multiple nested systems interacting together to achieve a unified outcome. And I think this is the interesting thing when you say, like, let's say consciousness, right? For example, again, I think it's not the most interesting question, but we'll go back to it. Where does something like this exist in the brain? If you cut out a neuron, is that conscious? No. If we cut out a slice, we'd still say no. In fact, even if you take a brain, you lump it down there, it's sitting in a vat, empty vat. Brain, no, not conscious? Not conscious. We will probably agree.
Yeah.
It's this amazing thing of it's the interaction between the systems. Through that complexity of their interaction, something else emerges. And that's a fascinating thing. And the fact it can do it, we know is a ground truth it can do it. As you say, 20 watts, 50 watts, pick your number, it's small. Is a remarkable feature. So let's use that technology. Let's use that system.
Neuroscientist Brett Kagan, an optimist there about an AI-driven future on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. He's joining renowned theoretical physicist Paul Davies, cognitive scientist Ines Hipolito, and they're with Sandra Peter, whose work focuses on emerging tech and AI in business. If we give AI the key to our brains, how will we know if things go wrong?
You know, with humans being so stubborn, and yes, I subscribe to that. What are we meant to do if AI says we're wrong? How are we meant to know if it's right or wrong?
What I would say is that in a context where increasingly we are bombarded with this misinformation, how do we prepare for that is the question. And I would say that critical thinking is the way to go. Getting very strong skills on critical thinking to be able to understand what is the difference between, you know, things that are being thrown at us, being able to adjudicate what is going on is precisely the way to go. Another way to go is to be part of these kinds of venues where these discussions are being had and they just really bring up the state of the art. That that's another way to go. One last one is I think that we need to shift focus from things that are more hypothetical, like should robots have rights or, you know, AI be conscious, and look into what are the right now, the implications and the impact of AI in our communities in a very diverse kind of way. That would be the way to go forward.
If I can add on that, yep. I think a beautiful thing to realize as well is that when we're investigating this, we talk a lot about consciousness, we've talked about intelligence, but there is another uniquely human thing, which is intuition. And intuition ultimately is an emotional outcome, I think, I believe. It's just an opinion, actually, that one.
Paul, in a second.
And I think what's fascinating is that I think if intuition arises from emotion, it really, as humans, we subserve emotions. And then we often come to an intellectual rationale why that emotion is the right thing to have. But quite often, intuition is able to be incredibly right about complex things, identify relationships in ways that we later have to figure out. And I think we need to become more comfortable in relying on our intuition and programming our intuition and aligning our emotions with true reality, not letting it be hijacked by social media or other people, but trying to figure out how to be us and access those unique capabilities to try and discern between all of the noise.
Paul, I think you want to...
There's a lot we could discuss. But briefly, we start off talking about consciousness, and we tend to think, you know, brain, consciousness, and so on. But most of what your brain does is not conscious activity. It's beavering away. You fall asleep. If, like me, you like doing crossword puzzles, and then you fall asleep, and you wake up, and immediately the clue's there. It's not your conscious brain that's done it. It's working away all the while at the subconscious level and delivering the result conveniently. So I suppose that intuition is something like this. There are aspects of our brain, we're not conscious of the activity, but they're sort of coming up with solutions and giving us hunches and the right answers. That's one part of it. The other, which really interests me, is instinct, which is not quite the same as intuition, but a lot of animals have instinct. Birds know how to migrate, to where to fly, and so on, even if they're not taught by their parents. So there's a lot of stuff that gets inherited, a lot of knowledge of the world that is inherited not through genes. There's some sort of epigenetic inheritance. I think this field is wide open. There may well be people in the audience here who know more about this mechanism than I do. I think there are unanswered questions about how information in general, knowledge of the world, is not only processed in the brains but passed on from one generation to the next, and is not all through learning.
Coming back to a few audience questions here, because I think people still are asking you, we've raised deepfakes a little bit, so I'm going to go to the deepfakes question, because it is coming up in a number of questions that people are voting up. AI is becoming really good at impersonating humans. What does the panel think about risks in this space?
The biggest danger is not that people are believing things which are simply not true, and there's an awful lot of people that do. It's that there will be things that are true that people will cease to believe. That when you feel you can't rely on anything, you've no idea whether the news is real or what you're seeing is real or a fake, there tends to be the assumption, well, it's all fake. And then when people tune out, they cease to engage, we lose the cohesion of society. If we don't have a common set of at least basic truths or ideas or principles, then I fear for the future of humanity. I'm very gloomy on this point.
I guess to follow up on that point in furious agreement, what might the antidote be? And I think it is to be an active part of the world, not a passive consumer and reactor to what's presented to you. We're not simply sitting here being subjected to the world. We are part of it, experiencing it.
I would argue that the next 10 years are likely going to be some of the most disorienting decade that we collectively face, not only as researchers, as scientists, but also as the public. We're facing a myriad of things, changing geopolitical orders, climate change, energy transition, and AI in every single form that we've heard here. What will be the impact on human intelligence?
Well, for sure, there will be an impact, that's for sure. Everything is going to have to be reorganized in the light of that. There are many, many, but I will just highlight that large language models like ChatGPT, which all of us are using, right? So they're going to have a tremendous impact in all across our lives, in society, and our jobs. What happens there, which I think that we really need to get public awareness of, is that those large language models that we interact with on a daily basis, we are interacting with them as if they were search engines. And they are not search engines. So these are, of course, it's a breakthrough in technology, but these are highly predictive power models that their sole purpose is to sound or to produce text that sounds like humans, right? So they will go into spiraling confabulation just to prove to us that they are human. So when we interact with these large language models, and we are not aware of this, and we produce outputs coming from these large language models, and we attach our name to it, that's highly problematic. And there are many ways in which it is highly problematic, but I will raise one of them. And one of them is that they are trained in Western data. So then what that means is that whatever falls out of Western data, science, knowledge, philosophy, whatever it is, it's just not going to have a voice. And this is also why many of the First Nations peoples have come up with a stance and a protocol on those things, because the output coming from large language models is something that is promoted as the neutral perspective. So many of the knowledges and sciences and all of that is just not going to be showing up. So I think this is a real world problem that we should focus on in the future, in the next 10 years, is how are we going to deal with this?
So impact on human intelligence in, you know, not foregrounding particular parts of our natural human intelligence. Brett?
I was listening and I was thinking, and what jumped to my mind is, imagine, you know, group of people dropped on a planet, no development, no history, nothing, and you give them a hammer. And you say, you can build a house with this. And so they start with the hammer and they're going to say, they use a nail and they go, wow, this works amazing. And you say, cool, now cut a piece of wood. What's the outcome? A lot of noise, not much cutting. They're not a clean break. And this is what we're at, essentially. We've got these cool tools. Like, as much as we can criticize, denigrate, and point out the flaws and limitations of stuff like ChatGPT, LLMs, they are cool tools. They're just one tool. They're a hammer. And when they're at the risk of being given this hammer and saying everything is now a nail and anything it doesn't work on means it's not a good hammer. Well, no, we just need to build more tools. We're at the start of a journey where we're able to actually set out and figure out what do we need to solve the world, to improve the world, and beyond perhaps even the world. You know, humans as a species have the chance to even leave this planet one day and, you know, welcome. I'm certainly in no rush to do so, but it's a potential that we as a species have. And I think this is what's the beautiful thing in the next 10 years, is we're now going to build towards a tool set that will improve not just our intelligence as organic creatures, but as a species level into hopefully something that exceeds what we currently are, and while retaining what makes us human. It's possible.
Do you want to speculate on, you know, what the next great tool is going to be in 10 years? We'll all be reading about some other.
Well, I think it's the integration, right? And I think unique processing powers of different tools. So, you know, a lot of people talk about this term called heterogeneous compute, which I'm sure you're both familiar with.
Nope.
And, but the audience might not be.
And it's this idea. I'll get there. Dramatic pause. And it's this idea that much in the same way we have something like a CPU and a GPU, we have these different parts that handle data in different ways. Maybe the future computers will also be integrating a quantum processor that does uniquely quantum-based things, and a biological processor, which will do uniquely biological things, and some other forms that we may not have even imagined yet. And that'll give us the capability.
I think what I'm hearing you say is that maybe it's worth thinking not in terms of what these machines will replace and then will be forced to find new and other things that only we can do as humans, but also also, they might replace some things that we do, right? Calculators and so on. But they might extend or enhance or assist, and we might be able to do things with these machines that we've never been able to do on our own.
Right.
Of course, in the same way that a hammer is an extension or a saw is an extension of the hand that wields it.
So now let me ask James's question. This is the most voted question at this point. At its limit, how will AI narrow the role of human minds? So pressing on this point, are there any unique characteristics of human cognition that can never be replaced by a machine? Maybe should never be replaced by a machine?
Of course. Absolutely. I think we should look at these as tools that you can use as scaffolds. Right? And we need to get skilled at using these tools, understand the limitations, like what I was mentioning earlier, where, you know, with ChatGPT, which is the most famous one, with ChatGPT, understanding that ChatGPT will go through all of this spiraling confabulation to prove to us that it is human, right? So understanding that limitation, you can still use ChatGPT for the tasks that we need to do. That's possible. The question there, or the kind of like the point is understanding that we are not going to go towards automation, but towards some kind of augmentation where we can engage with these large language models in order to help us as scaffolds to, you know, perform something else and deliver something else that it frees us up from something else. But the idea there is that we are fully aware of the implications of what, you know, it means to engage with these systems in privacy matters as well.
Paul, do you agree?
You know, I'm a theoretical physicist, and so we think that this
we
is
won't hold
the pinnacle of human intellectual achievement. And the question is, can some super-duper ChatGPT like thing come up with like a new theory of physics? And I can imagine, and indeed it's true at the moment, that computers are quite good at doing what physicists derisively call curve fitting. You know, give it a lot of data and it'll find relationships. And it's not unearthing deep new principles that are connecting bits of data together. It's just doing, just some easy fit. At least for theoretical physicists, we've got a way to go yet before we're pensioned off.
And I think it's worthwhile cutting to the quick, right, of what we're really talking about. You know, artificial intelligences, they're systems that work through layers of weights, mathematical models that will be updated, they'll move forward for a prediction, and then they'll be updated going through what's called backpropagation. And that's not how we work. And that's why they're not able to make these big creative leaps, because they're a process of iteration. And the hope that models, and they do work for many things, as you were saying, is that if you make small enough steps and you do it enough times, but enough times isn't a small number. It's not 20 times. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of samples to learn relatively simple tasks. That's not how any of us work. And the reason is this, to get back to physics, are these huge cascades of chaos, what we call criticality in the brain, that as we interact with the real world, we respond to it in this way that will cascade and avalanche as patterns in our head and coalesce on discrete and actionable items in order to control and minimize the difference between how we predict and understand the world and the actual outcomes we observe. And because of that, we can make these huge conceptual leaps that machine learning simply can't do. It's not trained to do it. And where is AI going to go next? They've fed it the internet. They've fed it all of the available human knowledge they can get access to, even knowledge that they shouldn't have had access to. And so where's the next step? And meanwhile, we still display abilities that these machines can't hope to have, despite their best attempts at pretending.
Is this scalable? Are we going, another 10 years?
The beautiful thing about biology is that it is scalable, right? We generate our cells from a number of different donors. What you can do is, for everyone, we don't take anyone's brains. What people can do is donate a bit of blood. You can turn that blood into stem cells, those stem cells into neurons, and stem cells grow exponentially. So it's very scalable.
We're not chopping up people's brains and putting them in dishes.
No, that's the beautiful thing about synthetic biology, is you can create these things in a way that, one, to your point, captures a diverse group of people also in a personalized way. So for our search for like drug treatments and stuff, we can capture different people's genetic structure in a way no different to blood you'd give to a doctor for a routine test, and understand how would you respond in these cases. So it's immensely scalable and applicable.
But let me bring it back to the question. LLMs, not great. Other systems that are good at things that LLMs are not?
Not yet. So what is happening is that we have LLMs and they look as something really powerful, and they are in many ways. The caveat there is that these are super powerful predictive models that are going to be giving you outputs that are coming from the past knowledge. What does that mean? That means that you cannot ask an LLM to make a real-world, real-time decision. So they can't do that. And that's put very openly by OpenAI. They need a breakthrough to get to that stage. So that would be something like a kind of like a distributed ecosystem of intelligence where you would have certain kinds of nodes that can make real world decisions. And that is not the case. I'll give you a very clear example. When we are delegating hard decisions in the hopes that these systems are going to be less biased than we are, and these are very hard societal decisions, like who is the CV that is going to be the most relevant for the position, and we ask AI assisted tool to decide that for us, that's not going to be a real world, real time kind of decision. It's going to be like based on the likelihood of people that, you know, got that kind of like CEO job given certain aspects on their CV. That's a real-world example, that's a real-world case of using these kinds of systems. So that's where we are not yet.
On ABC Radio National's live event show and podcast Big Ideas, where big thinkers tackle all these big questions of our time, I'm Natasha Mitchell. You just heard from Assistant Professor of Philosophy of Artificial Intelligence at Macquarie University, Inés Hipólito, who is sharing the stage at the Sydney Opera House with neuroscientist Brett Kagan and well-known author and theoretical physicist Paul Davies, with host Sandra Peter from the University of Sydney's Business School. Now, how might our brains adapt to a hyper-technological future?
Paul, in physics, systems, AI-based systems that do things better than LLMs.
Well, yes, I suppose I've already alluded to the fact that the changing the conceptual framework. If we had a system that could say, well, the reason you're stuck on, you know, string theory or unifying quantum mechanics with gravitation is you're thinking about the problem the wrong way. And there's a whole list of unsolved problems at the frontiers of science. They're very large, they're very small, they're very complex, and we hit barriers at all of them. Very often, you get beyond those barriers, not because you've overlooked a force or there's another particle to be discovered or something like that, but because you're thinking about the problem the wrong way. Change the conceptual framework. Oh, if we look at it like this, or we choose different parameters, or just a whole different way of thinking about it, then that could be the way forward. So we're stuck on these three frontiers, and I would just love to think that there is some sort of oracle that you could interrogate and say, you know, why are we stuck here? And that's because you've got to think it backwards or upside down, or you've missed out, you know, a whole new conceptual scheme. That's what I'd like.
I'll bring in another audience question here. If large language models don't have a concept of knowledge and so on, how will we measure how intelligent any of these systems are? What are the ways in which we can measure if they are at all intelligent?
To define intelligent, which is, of course, difficult. I remember I looked up a theory, like definition of intelligence, and I found a great paper, and they went through every definition of intelligence. They found 71 different definitions. So what did they do? They proposed a new one. So we had 72. I think like intelligence is a lovely term to capture a lot of things, but what we really care about is like specific functions at the end of the day, right? Like, can it answer a medical question? Can it do 2 + 2? And I think like once we start to break things down into its constituent parts, that's going to be a more useful way to understand these tools than simply trying to use big hand wavy, oh, it's AI. oh, it's artificial generalized intelligence. It can do anything. None of them can do anything yet. It's lovely to sort of have a nice catch-all term. It's convenient. That doesn't mean it's useful right now.
Paul, can we measure intelligence?
Well, there's so many different types of intelligence, and the one that we've skirted around is emotional intelligence. So this very important part of what makes us human. Do we want to build emotional intelligence into any sort of artificial intelligence? Looks a bit alarming. You know, do we want a grumpy AI that maybe refuses to cooperate because it's too early on a Monday morning? Or do we want an AI system that gives us an answer and then says, only joking, you know, change my mind?
God, so, yes, good money in that one.
one of the things philosophers talk about, think about, is should we replace juries? Would you be better off in the criminal justice system having an AI decide guilt or innocence? And that leads us down this whole path of criminal responsibility.
Where the law might never change because it's always based on precedent.
But the making a judgment about the guilt or innocence, outsourcing that to an AI, a lot of people might think that they get a better deal from an AI than they might from a...
Someone's suggesting we replace governments with some of these systems.
A government as well, of course. I mean, we can imagine a future, and of course science fiction writers do. There are many dystopian futures where there's some sort of big brother system that is running everything.
So we're talking about big brother systems, and we're starting to get to AGI, artificial general intelligence. I think it's worth unpacking that a little bit for the audience, because there's about five questions that get to super intelligence, artificial general intelligence. There's a couple of singularities down there. So let's unpack that. So AGI, for those in the audience that might not be so familiar with the term, is this idea that there will be an AI system that has the ability not only to understand, but to learn and to apply knowledge across a whole range of different tasks at some level that is comparable to human intelligence. And unlike the narrow AIs and the things that we've been discussing today, designed to do particular tasks, maybe it's facial recognition, maybe it's writing text, AGI would be capable of solving kind of general, any sort of problems and could adapt to these tasks without any human intervention. Where are we on AGI? Are we getting there? Can we see that in the future? Or is this something that nobody in the audience needs to worry about at this point?
So I think that we are extremely far away from anything like that. So there's nothing to worry about. That's at least the take-home message. Yes, indeed, what happened in the last 2 years is that large language models came in and they did change a great deal of our lives. And there are repercussions to that, and we need to take into consideration, like the ways in which the text that is generated or the images or the videos that are generated through large language models is going to impact our cultural practices, our cultural narratives, our cognitive development, our cognitive belonging, flourishing, mental health, and all of those kinds of things. So indeed, we should focus on that. In terms of AGI, I think that we are extremely far away from something like that. Because again, going back to what is the goal of any large language model like ChatGPT is to sound like human, but it cannot make any decisions, real world decisions at this stage.
Can I add the flip side to that? I also think we're extremely far away from AGI. We should be incredibly worried about that. That's what I would say, because ultimately, like, AGI is a realization of a new type of intelligence other than us. And that's incredibly exciting. It'll give us a chance to interact and extend and improve. These are amazing opportunities for us to extend what our capabilities are. And currently, there's no incentive for us to actually create equitable access to these tools. The current ecosystem that's being developed, I touched on it earlier, don't actually provide a way for people to engage in this. And AGI actually could bring in this ability for people to live these utopian lives if managed in the right way. And the risk to me is that actually what we're doing is building to a point where we can automate out significant parts of society, marginalize them, without offering them anything actually functional to replace them in a meaningful way. And so what I think we need is more investment in science, more investment in technology, so we can actually get to where we need to go, where as a society, we can sort of progress to the next level. We're currently stuck in this horrible and unsustainable middle area. We need to move beyond it, but in the right way.
What's the best thing that the audience, all of us here, what's the best thing that we can do to prepare for what's coming? I might start with you.
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm going to go out on a somewhat scary note about preparing, because we're talking about clever human beings designing AIs that are doing all these wonderful and somewhat scary things. But very soon, we'll reach the point where it's the AIs will be designing the next generation of AIs, and they the next generation and so on. And we can try to keep control over this by embedding human values in the systems that we create now. And we could try to put it so deep into the architecture of these things that you would hope that the next generation and the one after that and so on would carry that forward. But we know, just looking at biology, that this isn't going to go on in perpetuity. And there will be a time, a generation N, when these human values, which we hold so dear, would simply be discarded or replaced by something that we would regard as deeply evil. And we're unleashing something which we're only the first step, but at the end step might be something very, very sinister and alarming. So sorry to end on that sort of note.
Time
to go to the bar, I think.
Well, to juxtapose, it's true that we're at the start of it. That doesn't mean that there's an inevitability. And a number of people, especially businesses, love to sell inevitability, as you say, like the AGI claim. Oh, it's going to happen. We just need more GPUs. We just need more scale. We just need more data. Well, yeah, we're waiting, and yet we're yet to see these changes. So what I would say is we're not at this inevitability stage yet. We have the control. We can develop. We can approach. We can engage with ethicists. We can engage with people. And we can work towards a future that's not scary, but embodies the values that we want to see. And this is a beautiful opportunity in our society at this tipping point as we are to actually sit down and decide, what are these values? Do we want to live at a profit maximization world? Do we want to live where it's about control? Or do we want to live where it's about create, help, and support? And these aren't decided. I think what's scary is that we have to all engage to make this happen. We have to reach out. We have to talk to politicians, to our neighbors, our friends, and especially to those who we don't agree with, for us to come to a conclusion that we can all move forward together with.
Inesh, last word.
What? Wow, no pressure. Right. So I would say that the first thing to understand is that we are not one culture. We are diverse cultures, right? So that's the values that we need to understand as these things are coming up. And what is going to be the impact of large language models or any other kinds of AI into different communities with different values? And how are they going to operate in these different communities in different values? As we know for now, what we know is that they're extremely biased towards Western perspectives, which are promoted as being the neutral perspective. And that, of course, is going to cause the advantages that we are all very aware of. And I would say that that's the biggest challenge in the future, because implementing, integrating AI in an unchecked way in our businesses, in making decisions in our society, may actually take us back in progresses that we as communities may have already made. So that would be for me the main question towards the future.
Well, blurring the lines between the biological and the digital, what do you make of all those new frontiers, the promises and the perils, right? We always love hearing from you. You can email us at bigideas@abc.net.au. Hey, thanks to the Sydney Opera House team for hosting this event, with theoretical physicist and best-selling author Paul Davies from Arizona State University, Dr. Inés Hipólito, Assistant Professor of Philosophy of Artificial Intelligence at Macquarie University, Dr. Brett Brett Kagan, Chief Scientific Officer at the startup Cortical Labs, and Dr. Sandra Peter was hosting the event from the University of Sydney Business School. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Love having you with us on Big Ideas. If you want to join me in person at a live recording, head to our homepage, scroll on down, look for Be In Our Audience. Heaps coming up. And tell your friends about the Big Ideas podcast if you love it. In Australia, it's on the ABC Listen app, and that's your one-stop shop for all ABC podcasts. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.